We'll just share briefly again who we are. David was born and raised in Iran with missionary parents and lived there until he was 11. Graduated from the University of Washington. One of his master's degrees is in Near East Language and Literature, and currently is the director of the Intensive English Language Institute at Seattle Pacific University. I am bringing a different perspective to this. I'm born and raised in Seattle, never lived anywhere else until I lived in Kuwait. So it was quite a cultural shock to me to be transplanted for a year. Tonight we're going to talk about a sort of an overview of the Middle East region and its people. Unlike yesterday where we talked about the political and the strategic involvement and what all that meant, we're going to try to develop a sense of the mosaic of people, the dynamics of the different kinds of people that make up the Middle East and its culture, and that in the midst of that, the image of God is still very present, no matter how broken and suffering things are happening in that region. And that, unlike in other places, God is really central in the Middle East. It's amazing that their Islam really, and their focus on God, as well as the Christians in the region. David, do you want to?
Okay. As far as resources, there's several books in the Resource Center here. Every day I'm going to be plugging those books. That's one of our charges. And one is A Concise History of the Middle East. While we won't be talking history today, that is a good reference to give you a sense of how the tremendous diversity and culture there has come about. There's a tremendous amount of overlaying of culture after culture from Asia and Africa and Europe, as they have traders and warriors and travelers have and scholars have traversed the area. So that is one good resource. A couple other books, you might make a mental note in case you ever run across it in a bookstore. One is The Guests of the Sheikh, which is a classic by Elizabeth Furnia, who went to Iraq in the 50s and just wrote about her experiences. And we just feel that even though it's an older book, it's one of the better ones to give you a sense of what it's like for a Westerner. It's not sensational. It just gives you a feeling for the people and what it's like to live there. And then we've got an article here, and I'll just send this around about half each side. There's not too many, so maybe one for every two or three people, and kind of share it around. This is called The Women Behind the Chadors, and it's an article from a
Christian Science Monitor.
And after you've read it, maybe you can pass it along to the person behind you or something. And I like this article, and because it starts off with that image of the chador, which is the veil, the long veil that women in much of the Middle East and Iran included wear. And then it starts with that image, and then it sort of it goes behind the image of this veil and how sort of foreboding that seems in the West. And it gets into the personalities of the women who wear the veil and the fact that they're really not all that different in a lot of ways. They may have very different attitudes, but they're people, and that's the bottom line. So we just thought that was kind of a neat article. So that's it for resources right now. Oh, there is another one called The Middle East by Raphael Patai, P-A-T-A-I. It's an older book written in the early 60s, but I think it's one of the more interesting sociological studies. And it's from Raphael Patai that I found this term that I like very, very much. He refers to the Middle East as a... Nope, can't see that one. A cultural continent rather than a geographic continent. And the reason for this is if you look at the region, you know, it's not one continent, but rather a crossroads of continents. And so why is it referred to as a region in any case? It's very, very difficult to define. Middle Eastern scholars do not agree as to what the Middle East is. I mean, they don't really have a total consensus on how far it goes in any one direction. So therefore, there's a real problem. I mean, when you're talking about Australia, everybody knows where it ends. When you're talking about the Western Hemisphere, everybody knows what its borders are for the most part. But in the Middle East, there aren't those convenient geographic boundaries. So what are we talking about? Well, Raphael Patai came up with this very neat phrase, cultural continent, to define the Middle East. And what he means by that is that this region here, the people share certain characteristics, and they have a certain common history, a certain common heritage. And I think that's a very good way of trying to get a handle on the region. It isn't primarily geographic, but rather cultural. So that's just a starting point for us. And we'll move on from that to just briefly talk about what are the more or less accepted geographic boundaries, and then look at some of the cultural characteristics. And I would just say our style is to respond to questions as they come up. I mean, we don't, other than having an outline, we don't really have to get through any certain agenda. So if questions pop to your mind, we would like to entertain them. And we know that you're probably most interested in our personal experiences, people that we've met and known over the years. So whatever you want to ask, please do. Anybody want to ask a question? Okay. To begin with, real quickly, the Middle East is usually defined either by Syria in the north or Turkey. I tend to want to include Turkey simply because if you go back anyways at all in Middle East history, Turkey was the center of the Ottoman Empire. Is that a name that's familiar to you? The Ottoman Empire? It came from the family Osman, from a man named Osman, back in the 13th century. And the Ottoman Empire is one of the greatest empires the world has ever seen. Interestingly enough, if you study traditional Western history in high school or college, you hear virtually nothing of the Ottoman Empire, other than the fact that they attacked Southern Europe and were pushed back eventually. But this was a tremendous empire that extended up into Europe, into North Africa, more or less controlled the peninsula and over into Iran. So it was the major empire of its day, from about the 14th to the 17th century, mid-17th century. So I tend to include Turkey. Over on the eastern side, some scholars would want to stop at Iran and say this is the Middle East, Arab Middle East. But I don't see how one can exclude Iran because it's so integral to the history of the region. And then to the south, the peninsula, and generally it stops at Egypt, but some include Sudan. And of course, Egypt is really Africa as well. So that gets a little confusing. You know, how far west do you go to North Africa? Because all of North Africa uses Arabic as its main language. And Arabic is one of the most fundamental aspects of the Middle East. And the North African countries politically are very, very close to the Middle Eastern countries. But generally speaking, you have Middle East and then North Africa, and Egypt is considered part of the Middle East. Okay? Any comments on that as far as defining the region? Okay.
Up here.
Yes.
How do the Ottomans differ from other Arabs?
Well, Ottomans and the Turks are not Arabic. The Turks are Turkic. They have a different language family going related to Mongolian. And the Central Asian tribes is where they originated, actually Eastern Asian. Genghis Khan is one of them, and then his descendants, Hulagu and so on. And they came through in these great waves across the Mongolian hordes, they're often referred to in history books. These were Turkic. Before them were the Seljuk Turks. So even before the Mongolians were the Seljuks, who came through in great waves of migration. Some think that this is why much of Iran is desert today, because of their tremendous herds that came through and stripped the land. They ended up, many of them, in Turkey. And so this is a Turkish-speaking area, not Arabic. Now, they used the Arabic script, which looks like this.
Writing from right to left.
Mm-hmm. Right. This is al-lughat al-arabiyya, the Arabic language. And so the Ottomans used that script, but it wasn't Arabic. It was just a script used to phonetically spell out Turkish words. However, the Ottomans used Arabic for governance. That is, Arabic was like we use English in much of the world today. And it was the language of politics and governance. And Turkish was the language of everyday life. Okay? Any other question about that? Briefly, cultural characteristics about in the Middle East. What ties these people together? Well, I think a common history, obviously, is very important. In terms of the economy, heavily agricultural. I mean, virtually the entire area is heavily dependent on agriculture rather than, say, Great Britain, which for several centuries has depended on industry. And then, of course, more recently, oil has become kind of the dominant resource of the region. So they have agriculture and oil more or less as a common economic base. And then heavily religious, with virtually the entire area being a theistic in nature, rather than when you get further east into India and the subcontinent, having a monism or a pantheism being the religious influence. So this monotheism is a common, shared characteristic of the region. Patriarchal families, for the most part, a very highly ordered structure, social structure, whether it's village or city, from aristocratic, your military class, your tradesman class, and then your fellahin, the lower classes, the farming classes. So this kind of highly organized social structure is common to the entire region. Okay, so that would be what Raphael Patai is talking about when he talks about it being a cultural continent. It's having some of these kinds of common characteristics. Okay, and language. And I'm going to move right now on to language and just briefly talk about the important languages of the area. Arabic, which is related to Hebrew. Aramaic. Assyrian. Syriac as well. Arabic and Hebrew are so close that when I went to study Hebrew, I did an intensive course, it was almost embarrassingly easy. I mean, it was like cheating. I mean, it had 2 or 3 years of Arabic, and all these Jewish kids were struggling, And they'd had Hebrew, as they were growing up, but it was very difficult for them because they weren't really that familiar. But having had Arabic, it was a piece of cake. It was just like learning a new alphabet and then more or less the same language. And it just sort of strikes you when you first realize that. You suddenly think, wait a minute, these people are really cousins in the main sense of the word. They are very, very closely related, Jews and Arabs. So when they say they're cousins, they mean it literally. And then Persian, which Persians actually call Farsi, is the language of Iran. So Arabic is used in Egypt, North Africa, Syria, on down into the boot here. Sudan as well uses Arabic heavily. And then southern Iran, there are a lot of Arabs in that area. Okay, so Arabic is the dominant language in the region. And then Persian, Farsi, which is spoken up in Afghanistan as well. Persian is related to Hindi, and also Urdu, which is used in Pakistan, and then of course European languages like German. Persian puts the verb at the end. How many of you speak German? A few. You know how German puts the verb at the end, and Farsi does the same thing. Persian has words like na for no, baradar for brother, pidar for father, madar for mother. So you know that these are words that were not borrowed, that go back perhaps 10, 15,000 years. Very interesting. And then Turkic languages. There are many, many tribal groups in this region. Iran has 20 major languages. And there are just dozens of different small groups throughout the region. And then other, I'll say, including Armenian, which is a language, unrelated. I don't recall what. Anybody know what Armenian is related to? Offhand? I don't recall finding what that was, and other dialects. So those are the main linguistic groups. Let me just read you a sample of Arabic, so you can kind of hear what it sounds like. I got a request to do this in something from the Lord's Prayer in Arabic. Goes like this. أبانا الذي في السموات ليتقدس اسمك ليأتي ملكوتك لتكون مشيئتك كما في السماء كذلك على الأرض كفافنا خبزنا أعطينا اليوم ونغفر لنا غنوبنا كما نغفر نحن أيضا لمغنوبين علينا. And I forget the one which is about do not lead us into temptation. لأن لك الملك والقوة والجلال إلى الأخ. Okay, that's Arabic. And Persian goes like this, if you think they're the same language. ای پدر آسمانی ما، نام تو مقدس باد، پادشاهی تو بیاید، اراده تو همانطور که در آسمان اجرا می شود، در زمین نیز اجرا شود. نان روزانه ما را امروز به ما بده، خطایای ما را ببخش، چنان که ما نیز کسانی را که به ما خطا کردند بخشیده ایم. ما را از وسوسه ها temptation. Whispering, whisper. That's what it is. The whispers of Satan. از وسوسه ها دور نگه دار و از شریر رهایده، زیرا پادشاهی و قدرت و جلال تا عبدالباد از آن تو است. آمین. So that's Persian. That gives you a little feeling for the difference between Arabic and Persian. Those are the two main languages, and they're very different. And it's sort of that suddenly you realize, I mean, Persians and Arabs are very distinct, and they feel that way. To the point where we have lots of Arab and Iranian friends, and I'm often reluctant to even tell one group how close I am to the other group. I mean, they don't have a deep-seated animosity necessarily, but you're just more comfortable with your own kind in general. And so Arabs are happy if I speak Arabic, and I have lots of Arab friends. Iranians are happy if I know a lot of Iranians, and so on.
What about physical differences? The language is quite different, but it seems to me I wouldn't be able to differentiate.
Well, I've been mistaken for an Arab or an Iranian. So there are Iranians and Arabs who look very European because of the tremendous centuries and centuries of mixing. You know, the Crusaders came through and mixed in Lebanon heavily, and some of those people have mixed throughout the region. Iranians have, well, they're Indo-European, so they have European characteristics. And in the north in particular, they mixed with southern Russian, Georgian peoples. And they look very European as well.
I was even mistaken for Lebanese.
Yeah, they thought
Swedish,
she was a Lebanese.
So,
so you know, while we, of course, a lot of them, for the benefit of TV, it seems, don't shave their beards. And, you know, like, yeah, Arafat, you know, he cultivates that Don Johnson look, you know. But it isn't that easy to differentiate just by looking, although there's a certain type that you could say is Iranian, a certain type that's Turkish, and a certain type that's Arab. But within the region, there are a lot of both black people of Sudanese extraction, Ethiopian extraction, Somalian extraction, as well as people that are very light-skinned. So there's quite a range.
So much difference maybe in the wardrobe that might distinguish.
Right, definitely. I mean, Anne could speak to that. Could you recognize in Kuwait who was Kuwaiti versus Palestinian versus Iranian versus?
Yeah, most of the time, because
how could you? How would you describe them?
Well, the Kuwaiti men or the Gulf Arabs always wear the white. Well, it's white in the summertime, and then in the winter it gets darker colors. But the dishdasha. The lawn all the way to the ground. They'll wear a white headscarf in the summertime with the black band around. You've probably seen pictures of those folk, okay? And then sometimes you can tell by the collar style and the sleeve type whether they're Saudi or Kuwaiti or whether they're Omani. Oman has a much more distinctive. David's, we have some pieces of clothing here.
I'll put this on while she's talking.
What I think is interesting is they start off with something that looks like a yarmulke. It goes underneath that.
Kahfiyya.
And then, so this would be a typical, and it's fun to watch the Kuwaiti boys when they
start
cruise
dog and pony
the
show.
Gulf. they wear these headscarves, and they'll sit there in the rearview mirror fluffing their headscarf and getting the points in the front just right, because you either wear it pointed down or pointed up, and, you know, so that would be more Kuwaiti or Gulf Arab. I'm trying to remember now. I think mostly the Palestinians and so on would wear Western type of clothing. I mean, they would wear pants. Egyptians wear baggy pants, really huge baggy pants. The men, the women either wear the abaya, the black. I don't think David brought my abaya, but I have an abaya. The black thing with the scarf. The Bedouin wear ones that you only see their eyes. So that there's ways of telling some of them apart. That's mine.
So while you were there, you had to wear these things?
No, I actually wore relatively Western clothing. One of the reasons, except for the fact, well, mind you, I don't go around in halter tops to begin with, but I always made sure my shoulders were covered, and I was covered down below my knees, probably mid-calf length. Just a second. Can't dress and talk at the same time.
Here, just put this on. I'll feel more comfortable as soon as you get that on.
I know. I'm exposing my face.
This is how the young men would do it. They'd go like this. Look very stylish.
Oh.
Real chic.
They did let their hair show.
Huh?
They did let their hair show.
There's no men.
Oh, yeah,
religious.
The men are free to do anything. We saw a guy swimming in his boxer shorts.
And you'll see the guy run around like this. So there's nothing religious about it.
Anyway, I can't do this without a mirror, but then you'll have this, and then you'll have the big black thing over the whole thing.
It's a burqa. Now, in fact, there are many, you'd think that the more, quote, primitive people would tend to cover more, but in fact, in many parts of the Middle East, the village women are more free than people in the city. I mean, there's every stereotype you have, there are exceptions, there are contradictions to it. So you cannot, there is no way to simplify these kinds of dress codes and
practices. The one thing that I wanted to finish explaining was why I wore Western clothing and why I didn't wear the Arab garb. The only Western women that wore the Arab garb were Western women who had converted to Islam. Basically, in Kuwait, now that may not be true in some of the other Arab, probably in the Gulf countries. I'm not sure about like Syria and Jordan and not in Iran because you're required to wear the chador. But in Kuwait and in the other Gulf countries, the only Western women that wore those were women who had married Kuwaitis and become Muslim or had, out of personal choice, become Muslim. So I didn't really want to send that message. A lot of Kuwaiti women even wore Western clothing out in public. So it wasn't appropriate for me to dress that way. But I did dress conservative.
But if you would have been in Iran, would you have had to wear the chador?
You have to wear the chador, right? You're not allowed to. Well, today I can't tell you. That is probably loosening up again. But that has been true.
Since Khomeini, yeah.
You usually wear glasses. How would a Saudi woman
do that.
I usually wear contact lenses, and I knew I'd be up here, and I didn't want to worry about losing a lens. So I don't know what they do if they wear glasses, to be honest. I never saw that. The burqa was mostly worn by the Bedou out in the desert.
Desert women.
So if they had eye problems, they probably didn't do anything about them. I mean, they probably didn't wear glasses, would be my guess. But
or they just wear it underneath. So in any case, we've talked a little about the variety of styles of dress and so on, but we also wanted to give you more of a sense, not just of the appearance, but by the way, last thing I have here that you can pass around. This is kind of interesting because this is about 30 years old, and this is what a shepherd boy would wear. So this is the authentic thing. It's a hand-woven.
Our daughter wears it for Christmas.
This other stuff was made in Hong Kong, so this is the original. So, but we wanted to give you a sense of the tremendous diversity of people. Just in Kuwait, in Iran, and all these countries, you run into people that are some very cosmopolitan, many illiterate. You just tremendous diversity, and it's almost hard to put it together. I mean, we think of Middle Eastern societies as very conservative, and generally they are, but in Kuwait, they had the Turkish government and Kuwaiti government got together and did an exhibit, and part of the exhibition was a display of Turkish underwear or lingerie.
It was a fashion show.
A fashion
live
show.
Women wearing lingerie parading down.
And you know, you have all these Kuwaitis sitting around, and many of the women were covered with the veil, others were not, but we thought, no, what are these people thinking? You know, they're watching this display of lingerie. It was just, I couldn't have ever anticipated such a scene. And it just does not fit into any preconceived idea as to what this culture is. You know. Yeah, go ahead and talk about some of the people that we
thought we'd introduce you to some of our friends and give you little snapshots of some of the people we met in Kuwait to help you share with you some of the amount of diversity. As I said yesterday, more than half the people at the time we lived in Kuwait, more than half the people were non-Kuwaiti. That meant other Arabs, Indians, Filipinos, Americans, Europeans, Canadians, Japanese, just a variety of other folks. But these are some of the people that we met that were living there at the time. Ali was a young Iranian fellow who had about 3 years previous escaped Iran because of the war, for fear that he was going to be drafted in Iran-Iraq war. He escaped in a boat across the Persian Gulf, where many of the people that were in the boat died on the way over because of the heat and so on. Ali managed to get into the country, and through paying a lot of money, which was basically the requirement, he was able to get a working permit and a residence visa.
And we should just add, I mean, what a tremendous gentleman this kid was. I mean, he was only 19 or 20.
Yeah.
Had already was running his own camera shop and, you know, photography studio. And he would let us use his phone to make long distance calls. He didn't want us to pay him. He would always serve tea. It's just the most gentle, loving person that we ran into.
Yeah. Wonderful. Dorcas was a gal that we met. She was a Filipino nurse who had come. She had left her family in the Philippines, which meant a newborn child, maybe a few months old, with her husband for 2 years to work in Kuwait to help to send money home to her family to support them. One of the devastating side effects of the Gulf War was a lot of these expatriates, Filipinos and Indians and Sri Lankans, who left their family for a number of years to earn money to send it home so their family could eat, lost their jobs. And so Dorcas was in that position. She left Kuwait to go home to be with her child while we were there, and she was so sad all the time to be away from her baby, which is thoroughly understandable. Is this Abu Muhammad?
Yeah.
Okay. Abu Muhammad was in our apartment building. We had a caretaker that lived on the ground floor,
And as, I guess, is more European than American, they start with floor one is the second floor up. They call it floor one. And anyway, but on the ground floor then, there was an apartment that was for the caretaker. And Abu Muhammad was our first caretaker in the first apartment we lived in. And he was an Egyptian fellow and a little bit odd. He never knew exactly what to call me because but the reason why I didn't go by Anne was because there were so many Persian-speaking people in Kuwait, and Anne is a very nasty four-letter word that a dog leaves in your front yard. So I couldn't go by Anne. So poor Abu Muhammad, I tried to say, my name is Anne. He didn't understand that. I say Anna. He thought it. He ended up calling me Mrs. David all the time. So that made for interesting discussion. Our Kuwaiti family. We had a Kuwaiti family who we became very close to. Their son actually had become a very good friend of David's in the States before we got married. He was in our wedding party when we got married, and a year after we were married, when we were trying to decide whereabouts we were going to work, we had a couple of job offers in the Middle East. We chose Kuwait mostly because of Mazen and the fact that we would meet his family. They basically adopted us when we were there. We visited them regularly. Now, a visit meant, when we say regularly, that meant at least once a week. And it meant for a minimum of 4 to 5 hours. So we stopped by one time on Mother's Day to give Mazen, which is mother of Mazen and how she was addressed, to give Mazen a plant for Mother's Day. And we stayed for an hour. We meant to just drop it off, but we stayed for an hour. But we were informed that that was not an official visit because it was only an hour. And we needed to come back sometime that week to visit. They were very hospitable to us. You come in, you were served.
Well, they gave us a TV. They gave us all their cast-off clothing because we were the poor cousins.
Right, right. They don't have a Salvation Army or anything in Kuwait, so we were sort of where they donated. But I got some beautiful French fashions and some things from Greece.
Silk
and
stuff.
What language did you speak with them?
English, mostly. They spoke English very well. I kept and that's an interesting question, because David, who had studied Arabic for 3 years, could speak with them in Arabic. But so many people in Kuwait spoke English that he would talk to them in Arabic and they would answer in English. Because they were sure no American could really speak Arabic well enough to converse. And so I kept trying my little Arabic phrases and they would go, speak to me in English, I speak English. I go, I speak English too, that's not the point, you know. I was trying to learn Arabic. But so anyway, most of our conversations were then carried on in English. Except for a few occasions when they didn't speak, and then I would use my mixed Arabic and Persian and sort of muddle through. But they were very dear people to us. They have visited us in our home in Seattle since. And
they were there in the
they
war.
Were there during the war. They're usually out of the country. It's very interesting. They're usually out of the country in the summer. A lot of Kuwaitis leave. When it's 120 in the shade, you go somewhere else. And because they're wealthy enough to be able to go somewhere else, they usually leave the country. The Al Harbis, this Kuwaiti family, usually spent the summer in either, they alternated between Europe and the States. This last summer, however, their one daughter was getting married on August 2nd. So they happened to be in country at the time of the invasion. It took us quite a while to find out if they were okay afterwards. They all survived. We don't know yet what they went through, but we know that they're all still alive, and that was a great relief. The university faculty at Kuwait University was also a very diverse group of folk. Professors were brought in with PhDs were brought in from all over the world. The English language faculty all had to have master's degrees, and they were brought in from English-speaking countries. So a lot of Canadians, Brits, Americans, Australians.
We started speaking like British people after a while.
We had to sort of learn another form of English while we were there, too. We had to learn right. British English, which was very interesting. The taxi drivers, Yemeni, Palestinian, Kuwaiti, Lebanese, a variety of folk that you'd meet when you're taking taxis. We met a camel driver who was Sudanese, One of David's Kuwaiti students took us out to the desert to meet his family's herd of camel. I fell in love with camels. I just think they're the most wonderful looking animals. These big eyes and these smiles on their face. And so the legend goes, the camel smiles because it knows the 100th name of God. In Islam, there are 99 names of God, and the camel knows the 100th. And so he has the curious smile on his face. So David's student took us on an adventure out into the desert to find the camels, and we met the Sudanese camel driver who was very gracious and served us camel's milk on carpets out in the desert while the sun went down and the camels came in and bedded down. It was one of my favorite times there. David Rakai, I'd forgotten about this, but David brought up, reminded me of an experience. We were in Ali's camera shop one day, and this fellow who was from Bulgaria came in. He was an engineer, and he wanted some film developed. Now, you'll have to hit the languages that you hit, because I can't remember. He didn't speak English or Persian or Arabic.
Or French.
Or French, which are the languages David could do. And he was it German in there somewhere that he was trying? And
yeah, I think Ali used some German.
Yeah, well,
he was trying Russian.
We went through at least a dozen languages.
So sign language.
So a real variety of folk that do come into Kuwait that work for a number of years. Kuwait didn't really want people to settle too much. They didn't let you stay much longer than, I think, 7 years was some of the longest faculty that we had known. And people were either asked to leave or their visas weren't renewed or their contracts weren't renewed or something. But they didn't want you to be too comfortable too long, because they were worried about foreigners taking over, because there were so many foreigners and so few Kuwaitis. And I think that's something that's changed since the Gulf War, is they've talked about not allowing so many foreigners to come in.
We'll stop there with maybe take any questions or comments about Middle Eastern people in general. We just talked about Kuwait, and we've also visited about 5 or 6 other Middle Eastern countries between us, but you could say the same thing about most of them. Any thoughts, comments?
What you know about their culture, what are the possibilities of democracy ever being established there, or what are the chances for a better women's rights, human rights?
Yeah, democracy, very interesting. Israel is often known to say that it's the only democratic state. In fact, technically, Turkey was the first democratic state in the Middle East. Now, we don't think of Turkey as a democratic country because it's more or less a military rule kind of situation. But technically speaking, Ataturk, who was a great war leader during World War I, kept Turkey from falling apart into being divided up by European powers, managed to modernize Turkey and establish a constitutional government in the 20s. And so that was the first technically democratic state. Now, because it takes an educated public, you know, a literate public, to have a true democracy, Turkey didn't stand much of a chance initially. It was very tough going. And generally what will happen in Middle Eastern countries is that you have to have a strong leader who will, but sort of by force or magnetism, keep things together. But I think that really, the biggest problem still in the way is illiteracy, because something like 85% of Middle Eastern people are still illiterate. So, you know, it's tough to get anywhere. I mean, we tend to, in the Western media, tends to sort of project an image of the Middle East as a foreboding, anti-American, sort of violent place. Well, the irony there is that Middle Eastern people, for the most part, are just very ordinary people that see themselves as poor suckers, you know, that have just been shafted time and again. I mean, the average person on the street is just struggling to, you know, buy his morning paper and get a meal on the table. And many of them have very, very, very dim futures ahead of them because they don't have much education. And in Egypt, where 50 million people live, if you're college educated, there still isn't much chance of getting a good paying job. So the great hope for Middle Eastern people is to emigrate. You know, sort of like Ireland, you know, in the 1850s. If you stayed, you just were resigned to an existence of poverty. And so that's the reality on the street in the Middle East and out in the country, is that life goes on at a very slow, kind of mundane pace. And all the media hype about, you know, tumult and war and so on, I mean, for the vast majority of Middle Eastern people, that's just in the newspaper. And their lives just go on like it has for centuries and centuries. So I think the great challenge is, along with the illiteracy, the tremendous population growth. Egypt has one of the highest rates in the world, and as well as some of the other countries. So to try to keep pace and keep, you know, educate the youth, it's a tremendous challenge. And I just hope that as the Soviet Union and Europe and everybody kind of pulls together, that perhaps attention can be focused on the region and bring economic help and bring educational help to the region and get away from, you know, now that you don't have the superpowers playing ping pong with the region, perhaps, you know, a whole new era can develop, well, where education and literacy and so on is the focus. Healthcare is, for some, is good, but for many is very, very poor in the region still.
Question? You mentioned in Iran there was 20 different dialects.
Languages. There are dozens and dozens of dialects.
Is there one language that communicates to the entire population or not?
Right, Persian, Farsi. The language number two there, Persian, which is Farsi. Those of you who know your Old Testament is the language referred to in Daniel, where on the wall the hand writes "Mene mene tikli Parsin," and Parsin, the Parsi, were from Fars, which is southern Iran, and that's the language of Iran. And the great, you know, the empires, the Persian empires, had an older version of Persian.
What about the concentration of the wealth in such a small number of people? Is that actual or?
Right, I think that's pretty accurate. You know, the British had a heavy hand in that, keeping wealthy families in power, in control of the great oil wealth. And those families consequently were very friendly to British Petroleum. And, you know, British Petroleum controlled most of the Middle Eastern resources for several decades. And so that's where it is. And it's very tough to have those people share it. The Gulf countries have a tremendous... If you think about this, I mean, Kuwait had 97 billion barrels of oil. And that's equal to what Iraq had. It's a little less than what Iran had. It's about half what Saudi Arabia had. And it's just an incredible reserve. I mean, India should have this amount of oil. They don't even have to pump it in Kuwait. They just put a hole and the oil comes for decades. It keeps going. It just doesn't stop.
Can they do any farming at all there? Or is the
yeah, sure. As long as you no, as long as you irrigate, you know.
They had an experimental farm in Kuwait. Mm-hmm. We saw a picture book of Kuwait before we went, and it showed this lovely tree-lined street. You know, we kept looking for this tree-lined street because there isn't very much that grows in Kuwait. But they do have an experimental farm where they worked with hydroponics, growing just in water and nutrients without soil. They had dairy cattle, so we had fresh milk if you wanted to get fresh milk, or you could purchase powdered milk if you want, but fresh milk was available and fresh dairy products. So that there were those kinds of things that were grown there a lot, although most of the produce and so on were imported. They can grow.
I wanted to just remind you that this area here is referred to as a Fertile Crescent. And the reason for that is that this land in Iraq was irrigated for thousands of years and some of the best agricultural land in the world. It's very hot, but it produces a lot. And so as long as you have irrigation, they can grow crops year-round. And so Saudi Arabia has had massive projects going to be able to produce food and export food.
And so as long as they can get the water, they could be an exporting area. Egypt, of course, along the Nile, produces a tremendous amount of food, and this area has been irrigated heavily as well in Syria. And if there's been problems, it's mainly because of lousy socialist bureaucracy in places like Syria and so on, which went for the quick buck and ended up damaging the land and so on.
I think of the land as more like desert, but it isn't.
No, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of desert, but there's tremendous variety. There's mountains here, there's mountains. This is very mountainous area, mountainous terrain into Yemen, very mountainous here. All of western Iran is very mountainous in the north area here. Most of Turkey is quite mountainous, so it isn't primarily desert. The Bedouin desert Arab is a very small percentage of the Middle East population. The typical Middle Easterner would wear pants like we do, and that is the man. The women would wear, just a dress or, you know, fairly, nothing particularly unusual. And they would live in a city, and they would go to a police job or some kind of government, you know, post office job or something. Maybe have a partial high school education or maybe elementary. And live in either Egypt. There's 50 million in Turkey, 55 million in Iran, and 50 million in Egypt. So that's where the bulk of the people are. And those are not desert-dwelling people.
How much do they rely on the desalinization plants?
Just in Kuwait, mainly in Kuwait, and then some in the Gulf.
Saudi Arabia
does too. Right. Yeah, they have, of course, the rivers in Iraq and Iran. Turkey has a lot of water. Water is a very hot issue, by the way. I mean, the 67 war partly was waged over water rights because there was a threat to cut off water to Israel. So water is one of the real powder kegs in the region politically. So, they can't survive without it. But the water comes from Turkey down in Syria and then from Lebanon down into Israel.
In Kuwait, they had the largest desalinization plant in the world previous to the war, and that's how we got all of our water. It was every day, and very few neighborhoods had pipe in water. But basically, we had huge drums on top of the roofs of the buildings or homes, and every day the water truck would come and fill up the tanks. And you could always tell in the wintertime, or in the summertime, the tanks were very, very hot. So you'd shut off your hot water tank, and whatever water was stored in your hot water tank, you used for cool water. And the water that came off the roof was your hot water, because it was heated, believe me. But,
actually, more than 120.
In the shade?
Yeah, on the rooftop, it'd be 140.
Oh, I heard 175 at one point.
The water itself was probably 150. Yeah.
Almost boiling. So.
Before we run out of time, we do want to give you a little sense as to the tremendous sophistication of the educated classes. While there are all these illiterate people, the Middle East is, as you know, is a region that has a tremendous heritage. And the Persian language, after the Arab conquests over the region, Persian became the language of literature as it had been, and language of science and poetry. There is a very famous poet called Omar Khayyam. Now, some of you may have seen the book, The Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. But it's really a neat set of poems. And it's very typical, very, very typical Iranian sort of melodrama. And very sophisticated, too, because poetry of the 11th, 12th, 13th century usually was tied to mystical kind of thinking. And so they would use common images to describe a spiritual reality. So this is the end of the poem, and he says this, describing after he starts off with the dawning of the day, the beginning of spring, how wonderful life is, and he uses talks a lot about how, you know, you only live once, you should go for the gusto, drink wine. This is where a loaf of bread, a jug of wine comes from. And you're thinking, Middle East, you know, we don't think of, you know, carousing, drinking wine. But in fact, much of Middle Eastern history has a lot of carousing associated with it. But at the end of his life, he becomes reflective and he says, "Alas, that spring should vanish with the rose, that youth's sweet-scented manuscript should close, the nightingale that in the branches sang, ah, whence and whither flown again, who knows? Ah, love, could thou and I with fate conspire to grasp this sorry scheme of things entire? Would not we shatter it to bits and then remold it nearer the heart's desire? Ah, moon of my delight, who knowest, no wane, the moon of heaven is rising once again. How oft hereafter rising shall she look through this same garden after me in vain? And when thyself with shining foot shall pass among the guests, star scattered on the grass, and in thy joyous errand reach the spot where I made one turn down an empty glass." Tamam shud. And he's talking about how others go before us and we follow, and we become part of the earth, and then the earth grows more flowers and the roses come, and the cycle of life and the struggle between enjoying life or being a philosopher and reflective. But Persians love, they love sad songs. The songs are like country western. I used to grow up hearing it, and I always ask my parents, why are they so sad? They are so morose, you know. The other aspect of Persian culture that is quite famous is, along with the Persian rugs, Persian miniatures. And I'll make this available to you to look through, and you can see some of the miniatures in there. But this art is the best in the world, the Persian as far as miniature art goes, and very, very refined. Brass and other kinds of crafts made in Iran are among the best in the world. If you go today, the industry of the crafts industry is not doing too well after, you know, 10 years of mismanagement by the clerics. But this is an example. This plate is very interesting. Was given by my parents to some other missionary friends for their wedding 37 years ago, and then they gave it to us for our wedding, which was very nice. But I'll pass this around, and this shows the fine detail work that is done in Iran and other parts like Damascus. It's very, very beautiful work. And then this, I'll pass this one the other way. This is kind of interesting. I suspect this is a tourist item. But deer are very popular in fiction in the Middle East. And this has typical sort of ancient Iranian motifs, the kings of old on there from the great empires. And the lion is another imperial symbol. And so you have this sense of heritage that's very, very common throughout the Middle East. Whether it's Egypt, and they have a lot of paraphernalia about the pharaohs, Iraq and the Babylonians, in Iran it's the great Persian empires. And then this is a hand-painted bowl. Those are birds and flowers in there. It's very, very nicely done. And that's another piece that probably came from Isfahan. I would just also add that for architecture, you might have heard of Cordoba in Spain, where they have this famous palace that's got fantastic arches and beautiful architecture. But that the inspiration for that was in the Middle East, and the mosques, the religious centers, particularly of Isfahan in Iran, are fantastic. They really are fantastic. They have these domes that are just perfect geometrically. They were made in the 17th century. And you just stand in the middle and you look up, and they're just a perfect circle, perfect dome, and they're made up entirely, the interior is made up entirely of mosaic stones that big. And the designs are perfectly symmetrical. I mean, these domes are maybe 50 feet, 80 feet wide. And the entire thing is just totally symmetrical. You just cannot imagine the time that it would take, you know, years and years to painstakingly put that together. It's just spectacular architecture. So that gives you a little sense of our enthusiasm. Here's a typical print that you could get in Iran. And this is just a cheap thing, you know. Yeah. I don't know, it probably costs us a few bucks in Kuwait. I don't know, it's pretty common really in Iran.
It's probably about $20.
Yeah, I don't remember.
This one is silk.
But this is not, I mean, the best that they can do. They do carpet, which is really nice, and which is quite impressive. But they do block printing, it's quite common, and these are tourist items that you can buy in Damascus or other parts of the Middle East.
We could buy a lot of Persian-type prints and carpets and things in Kuwait, because as the young fellows and families, I guess, left Iran to escape from the war, and they came across the Gulf and settled in Kuwait, they would bring some of these things with them to sell to support themselves. So the market was full of a lot of Persian crafts and tapestries and carpets and things.
We've just talked too much. I wonder if you have any questions. We're almost out of time.
We talked about dress and everything. I've had this thought for a number of years that it would be, the dress that women wear, it seems like they have to hide themselves. This is mandated on them.
Right, that's a good question.
Do they then feel, right. Is there any sense, is this just through our Western eyes, or do the women there feel a sense of oppression?
I don't know if you want to answer that. We have that other question. You asked that as well, and I didn't answer that. Would you like to talk about that?
Well, my sense is that the women found some freedom in dressing that way. I wished I had been able to wear the abaya at points, because I felt uncomfortable with the way men were openly lecherous, either verbally or just non-verbally, but they would never touch me. Of course, their hands would be lopped off, but they could say things, and they could stare. I mean, I was covered one time all the way except for my ankles, and I had sandals on, and this guy in the bus drooled over my ankles for a couple of miles. It was very irritating. But the women, it was fine. They would adopt the veil at some points because of religious conviction. There was one woman we didn't really mention, but she was one of the first people in the media in Kuwait. She was on the radio. She was very well known. We were interviewed on Kuwait radio once and got to go to her home, met her daughter. This woman, her and her husband had been educated in the States, were very westernized. I mean, she didn't wear veil. She didn't wear anything. She was quite verbal, vocal, you know, right out there with her opinions, had as much freedom as I can imagine any woman having, even in the States. And at one point, her daughter, about halfway through the time there, we went to visit her a second time, had adopted the veil. And she just had some sort of religious experience and felt convicted to put it. No one told her to put it on. She chose to put that on. Underneath these veils, I was amazed. I went to a wedding, a Kuwaiti wedding, and was amazed as the women disveiled. They had gorgeous French fashions. These were beautifully, artistically made up women. I mean, they were just beautiful with gorgeous clothing and tons of jewelry. And but they chose to adopt the veil. I don't know. It's hard to talk about women's rights in Kuwait in the same sentence in some ways. I think that the war made some difference. I've heard a Kuwaiti woman talking about wanting more rights now for women in Kuwait. Women in Kuwait don't vote. It's hard. Part of, I felt like what my job was to understand where they are there. That if I come in with all of my Western perspectives and try to put that on them, that's not fair either. But I was really trying to understand what made them tick. And I don't know, do you have something to add to?
Yeah, I got into a discussion earlier today about this, and I guess the way I look at it is that where when Muhammad came and Islam kind of took over the area, women's status actually improved. That was about 640 AD, 620 to 640 AD. And they had been at the status of cattle or slaves, and they moved up to the status of sort of second in line to men. But it kind of stayed there. And then with European influence, the laws began to change. Egypt's laws over the past 100 years have become very much like Western law until recent years when they became sort of more reactionary. But the basic fact of the Middle East is this great tension between Islamic law and the Western secular law. And if a government says, well, we're going to chuck the Islamic law and go secular, they may end up being thrown out as a government. So, and in many cases, the women might even support throwing out that government. So it's very, very difficult to say what the solution to that is.